welcome to No Encore. This is Alan Bennett, not Dave Hanratty.
Hi, Alan.
Hello. How's everyone?
Hi.
Good.
Hi.
Dave is sick and couldn't be here, so I got roped in at the last minute. So
literally the last minute.
But here we are. It's the revisit episode, and we're going to 1997 today. So helping me, you heard there Kieran McGuinness from De Laurentiis.
How you doing?
We have Stephen White from The Last Mixtape, Una Mullally, author and writer with The Irish Times, and Carol Keogh, legend of Irish music.
We discussed this beforehand.
We did, and I went with
really
it anyway.
Wanted it to be called.
I did. I demanded it.
Wouldn't come into the room.
From Plague Monkeys, Automata, and the Tycho Brahe. So everybody, very welcome.
Thanks.
So 1997, Kieran, what was happening that year?
Okay, so loads of stuff.
Okay.
Hong Kong became free from Britain, right?
Wow, that was that year.
Oh, yeah.
Diana, Princess of Wales, died. Mother Teresa died. B.I.G. was killed. Wow. O.J. Simpson was found guilty. Serious, you know? Dolly the Sheep. It's like pivotal stuff, wow. You know? Internet Explorer 4 was released. People were queuing outside as if it was a concert. It's so embarrassing. And then the film that won... This is a random one. The film that won Oscar the Best Picture was The English Patient.
Oh, that was huge.
That's a pretty...
Best remembered for the Seinfeld episode. Isn't it the one where she goes, I don't like the English patient, and everyone else is just like, can't stand her or something like that. Everyone starts shunning her like across the room.
And the Father Ted episode.
With the English...
When Graham... Really? Or when... what's his face? Oh my God.
Jack.
No.
No.
Google. Graham Norton basically is trapped in the cave and he's like, have you seen The English Patient? That's my favourite.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be the one where Jack was a drinks the toilet duck and he dies and then he comes back at the end.
What? How does that relate to The English Patient?
I thought it was like a piss take. I haven't seen The English Patient, so I thought it was...
Spoiler, that's not what happened.
Okay. No. There's no toilet duck in The English
The albums thing. Of the year were... I don't know if they were albums of the year, but the big albums of the year were OK Computer, Radiohead.
Oh, yeah.
Be Here Now by Oasis.
Terrible
Pavement, Brighten
album.
The Corners. Biggest selling album, Spice Girls, Spice. Tons more. Bjork, Homogenic, stuff like that. There's loads. It was a really, really, I suppose, a lot of the huge albums of the 90s, like were around this 97 period. I don't think that's necessarily reflected in our list or anything like that, but yeah. So in 1997, I went to my first gig.
Right,
Radiohead. I was
That's
too young.
Pretty cool first gig.
But,
where was the Radiohead gig?
It was the one that Tom York wrote the song about because he was so freaked out.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It was in the RDS.
Yeah.
And I went with my bigger cousin, and he got a bit tired of me being on his shoulders. But it was my first gig.
Mm. Nice.
Pretty cool.
It was the last time my mother went to the cinema.
To The English
Yes. No, she saw Titanic.
She's like, never going again.
She saw Titanic. It's the last time she's been in the cinema.
Oh, Titanic was out
that
year.
Yeah. As well. Gosh, yeah.
How was that not the biggest film or like the Oscar winner that year? That's incredible. Yeah.
Well, Oscar winner.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose like the next year, wouldn't it?
True fact. Like, yeah, it won Best Picture, didn't it?
I'm pretty sure.
Did it?
Think so.
Okay, well, let's find out in our next
show.
Check in for 1998.
You were recording an album with the Plague Monkeys.
I was thinking about this earlier because I was going to say that we were in the process of recording an album that came out in April 1998, which was Surface Tension, the debut of the Plague Monkeys. But actually, we signed a record deal, which fell through in 1997. That was a big event of that year for us. So we had spent a year negotiating a record deal with a company called GHQ, who were a sub-label of Arista, which were a big label.
Mm.
And we had big management, not our big management, but big legal representation to negotiate this big four-album deal. And we signed it. And then they hired a new MD for Arista, who axed all the sub-labels, and we were dropped, along with a few other bands. So that was the start of my illustrious start of my career.
Does that hold up the whole album?
Well, what it did was it meant we had to do it independently, essentially. You know, we got a small amount of development money from an A&R guy called Tom Zuto, who would have been big name at the time. You know, he had been the scout for Geffen, and he had signed Guns N' Roses and a few other people like that. And for some reason, he was interested in Ireland at that time. So he gave our band and a few other bands that I know of some development money, but nothing came of it. Might have been a tax write-off, I don't know. Mm. and then we just had to do it ourselves. So our management released the album on their label in 1998. Saints. You can have that on your next show.
Well, a Saints sooner thing happened. We got signed, massive deal, blah, blah, blah. Well, it wasn't even a massive deal. It was just that it was like a big deal.
A deal was a big deal at the time.
It was with Virgin, a V2, and then they folded. Yeah. And we, so it knocked us. It knocked us for six. But I mean, you got the album out. We got the album out as well, but it was.
It's not quite the same. No, it doesn't have the same momentum, you know. I think because I was in my early 20s and just out of college, I don't think it devastated me maybe as it should, as much as it should have done, you know.
Now when I look back, I wish it devastated me more.
Well, I know. I can see what an impact it had, you know. Yeah. How, like, it's quite hard if you don't get. Go roaring out of the traps. It's a lot harder to kind of build momentum, you know. So you find other motivation for keeping going, essentially. And then the whole arse fell out of the industry. And that was that. She says cheerily.
Spoilers for next couple of episodes there.
So what was everyone else up to in 97? Do you remember? Or?
I don't remember. I was 14. So I was probably listening to lots of Hole and... Suicide and bands like that. I have a really terrible memory. Like, I think I remember probably about like 5 incidents from like school or something. So I couldn't tell you what I was
all of school.
Yeah, not just like that year. I can't. So, I mean, when I think of 97, all I can think of is, oh, that's 3 years after Kurt Cobain died. That's basically my reference point.
Yeah, okay,
I do remember. Hearing Wannabe by Spice Girls in a petrol station in Meath and thinking it was like the worst song ever and then coming around to it completely. Okay. So that's my 97 memory.
I'm pretty sure I thought it was terrible as well at the time.
With the Spice Girls?
Yeah, with Wannabe in particular.
I think Wannabe was actually, you know, a really innovative track. And I think at the time... I couldn't engage with it because my musical sensibilities were so outside of radio pop and that kind of stuff. But when you hear it now, I mean, it's such a strange song and it's
quite aggressive.
Cool. Yeah.
For a pop song.
Yeah.
It is quite aggressive.
Totally. And the
it's
video.
Girls, you know.
Video is awesome and stuff.
It's funny as well. It's kind of, it's like it, you know, it. Tells you all about their. It's like they detail all their personalities. It's like the, it's like the perfect track for introducing.
Like, hey, we're the Monkees.
Yeah.
It's a pilot.
We're more like the intro to one of those Australian tween kid shows. Hi, I'm Brian, and I like that. I'm Sandy, and I like
all memorable tracks, though, aren't they? And when you look back at the Spice Girls, I mean, like a lot of those tracks are pretty kind of ingrained in memory.
Two Become One is a good song.
Yeah, it is actually.
I like the video. I remember I started working in a bar, I think, that Christmas. And there was a girl that worked there, and she was kind of. I started smoking because to get a break, you had to smoke, you know? Otherwise, you didn't get a break. That was just what happened. So you just end up. Taking all the things off the tables. So I used to go out, and I remember I went out, and there was two of the kind of older girls, like who were like 19, and they were smoking, and one of them was like, I mean, she says, I want a man, not a boy who thinks he can. And they both were like, that is so true. I was thinking, well, the Spice Girls are, they must be so philosophical, you know?
Deep.
God, thinks he can what? When I was like 1997, I think I was about 12 at the time. So I think I was probably finding my taste in music. I think more importantly, like I think when you're that young, you become a bit more tribal. Like you were saying, like you have a, you know, this is my scene, you know, grunge or alternative rock or something like that. Yeah. And I think around then, I might be wrong about this, but wasn't Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness around this point in time? I might be wrong by a year or so.
It might have been a year before, yeah.
That's probably, for me in my teenage years, that was the huge album, like, that got me, man. Mm-hmm. You know, 1979, even though I wasn't even born then. It got, you know, kind of got me. And I think, like, a lot of time listening to the radio and kind of finding a musical taste that was independent of my parents, who are so influential musically, that none of them played any instruments, but I had my father this massive record collection that he would like play. We didn't have enough money for a TV or anything like that. We were quite poor growing up. So like finding kind of something independent and very independent of what they listened to was kind of important to me, which is difficult because my mom was a punk. So like anything that was kind of like alternative,
cool
she
stuff.
Was already, like the Pixies and stuff she would listen to. So it was hard to find that kind of...
So the Spice Girls.
Spice Girls, I went straight for it. I said, look, man, this is my life and this is what I'm going to listen to. I identify with Sporty Spice.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know. So yeah.
And Billy Corgan. Yeah. Spice Girls and Billy Corgan together at last.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably their last hurrah, wasn't it? The Smashing Pumpkins, like the, I think Billy Corgan. That,
they had, your one left, right? Darcy left.
Yeah.
And then they did, I think, Machina. No, they did the one with Perfect on it, which was... Yeah, that was a pretty good album. It had Apples and Oranges, which is one of my favourite Smash Pumpkins. I'm sorry, I'm a big Smash Pumpkins. Then they did Machina, The Hands of God, I think in like 99 maybe, and that was a big hot mess, and I think that was the end of them. But
yeah, they kind of disappeared for a while and then we reappeared.
Well, they had Zwan, they had Machina and one, and they had Machina 2, then they had Zwan.
Zwan, yeah.
And he was being creepy and happy. Yeah, it was so weird. It was like, stop, Billy Corgan.
I saw Smashing Pumpkins play a couple of years ago, actually, now that you're mentioning them. And it was the first time I'd ever seen them, I guess. Maybe not. But, oh my God, it was an amazing show. Like, they were just, I just turned back into Glastonbury. It was like in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
And, it was awesome.
Our first gig... Like through a friend of a friend of a friend, we stayed in one of Billy Corgan's houses. He has a couple of houses in Chicago, and his cat Satan. You might have to mind his cat, and his cat's called Satan. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, let's go.
I think all cats are Satan.
Indeed,
Kieran, you're 97.
Yeah, just nothing happened except OK Computer.
Okay,
I came down the stairs, and I remember when Diana died, my mother was really upset in the kitchen. She's like. She kind of gave me, I'm putting my hand up here, but she put her hand up to me, and then my dad went, then Princess Diana died. And I said, for whatever reason, I still remember. It was like this huge thing in the house. It was like, you know, you know?
Well, it was a big thing.
Yeah. It was, but it was.
Most people can remember where they were.
But I honestly don't remember another like moment, like, you know, obviously 9/11, all those kind of things that happened. Yeah. You remember them. There are things that happened that you were kind of part of them happening. Mm. But like, that was like, I came down and. Other people, it was happening to other people, and I was just like, what?
I think as well around then, like, you have 24-hour news, like Sky News and stuff like that, like covering something ad nauseum. So it's probably the first time any of us witnessed like that. Like,
yeah, I mean, two of the most seismic moments in popular culture, really, Diana dying and OJ being let off, you know, in terms of the format for... You know, a complete change in journalism and a complete change in reality TV.
Media coverage in general.
I mean, everything kind of springs from those two events that we're looking at now, I think, in a large way.
So before we look at the shortlist for this episode, let's look at some of the albums that didn't make it.
I'm so frustrated that... why don't we do the shortlist? Because I think you'll know why I'm frustrated.
Okay. Well, the shortlist for this episode, we've basically kind of everybody voted and zoned down on the five albums that were most popular among the group. And it was U2, Pop, David Holmes, Let's Get Killed, The Corrs, Talk on Corners, The Revenants, Horse of a Different Colour, and Sack, Butterfly Effect.
Yeah.
So what's missing?
Well, the thing was, because there was such a strong... like, Pop got, you know what was true, the Corrs got lots of votes, and so there was a lots of ones that got third votes, or so there was a draw between Sack and the Grand Parade by which was one I voted for, the Grand Parade by the Frank and Walters, but because Carol's first choice was Sack, then that sort of went through because Grand Parade was my
it's a complicated process.
Yeah, it's like the PR voting system.
But I mean, yeah, because otherwise you just have tons of draws because you know you can only vote for two. So I was a huge fan of I never heard it before, The Grand Parade by Frank and Walters. And I was talking to Ashley from the Frank and Walters for a previous episode where they were the album that was recommended to be to revisit from 92, which is Trains, Boats and Planes. And he was talking about the album and the mentalness of it. And the fact is, that was 92. This is 2000. This show is 1997. There's 5 years between the first and second album because they were so busy and everything else had happened. And he said it was a far better album. So I was looking forward to hearing The Grand Parade, and then I really liked it.
It was a great album, I have to say.
I really liked it. And
it's not what you said in your voting, Carol.
Well, didn't say it was the greatest.
And so, I just think it's a really good album. I think lots of tracks like Colours is one of them. There's a track on it about the Russian submarines or whatever, and I was like, Trump in charge. This is so, so like today. But I'm just ashamed that didn't get in.
Okay. Also, Nick Kelly didn't make it. Anyone have anything to say about that? Keela?
It was on my shortlist.
Was it?
Both were, actually. Yeah, Keela and Nick Kelly.
I kind of would have liked to have seen Keela get through. That album had a huge impact on me, actually. I kind of grew up listening to trad. Probably the opposite of your household. My parents didn't really have music in the house at all, but traditional music was really where it was at. And Keela were like a huge access point because it was the first time that my peers were, it kind of like the way the gloaming is now, the way like gloaming is absolute like hipster music now from people who haven't really listened to that much trad. I loved gloaming, by the way. But so Keela was like, people were getting into it. And I remember seeing Ontaif Tuilimach on the Ireland Top 30 chart show on RTE2.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was like, oh my God, because I went to an all-Irish school as well, and Keela went to my school too, and so it was just like, oh my God, like there's Irish on the pop chart, you know, and it was bit, you know, big deal. And they're Keela are probably one of my favourite Irish bands, actually. So yeah, I was sad that it didn't get through, but I probably should have put it number one if I wanted it that bad.
I had the same dilemma. I mean, Keela were on the list, but they didn't make it high enough for it to make the shortlist.
Awkwardly, like, I'm probably a number then in this one. I've always had a mental block with Keela. And I went back and listened to this record. And I don't know what it is about it. It just makes me incredibly fidgety in the sense of I'm listening to it.
It's
and
fidgety
like,
music.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like
it's know, made for dancing.
Distracted by something else. Like, oh, there's the time or something. Or what's on my phone? I can't really engage with it. I understand a lot. I've seen their gigs and people absolutely go for it. So you know that it's kind of a mental block with yourself, rather than a mental block with everyone else, you know, that kind of.
Yeah,
I've never just connected with it. Yeah, I have to say, and when, as try as I might with that album, it made me feel uncomfortable. I have to say, I was kind of.
It's your fault. It's not on the list. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's what. Yeah,
it's also your fault that.
hey, look.
So let's talk about some of the albums that did make it, and first we'll go with the Corrs, "Talk on Corners," which sounds like this. I never really loved you anyway. It was Dave who had a look at this album, so he sent in an audio clip. And this
from
is
his sickbed.
From his sickbed, and this is what he had to say.
Greetings from my sickbed. I'm having a rough couple of weeks, kids. Did the Corrs' wildly successful second album ease my pain somewhat? Well, let's start off by saying that Only When I Sleep is still an absolute belter of a song. What an opener! I mean, this is the Corrs showing some teeth while balancing their fusion of quaint traditional Irish music heritage and more contemporary pop rock leanings. Frankly, you'd want for more of this sort of thing in their career. Talking Corners is a strange one, and it's a good insight into the industry during this time. It comes out in 1997 and the singles don't set the world ablaze. Smash cut to a high-profile televised gig at the Royal Albert Hall on the following St. Patrick's Day, some heavyweight UK media attention, and a subsequent re-release of the record with the cover of Fleetwood Mac's Dreams on it, and boom, the album goes on to become something of a commercial juggernaut. Is it any good, though? Well, yes and no. I mean, again, it represents a strong illustration of what the Corrs are about, but hey, that's what the first album was for, right? This time around, the siblings concentrated heavily on songwriting, and even had some scraps with the record label who weren't terribly enamoured with some of what they were hearing in the initial stages. They worked with big money writers and producers and still wound up with a Fleetwood Mac and a Jimi Hendrix cover. They got painfully over their time remix act Tin Tin Out involved. They pushed hard for the likes of So Young, which skirts the kind of line that Bewitched gleefully danced a jig over. I mean, in some respects, Talking Corners is a mess of its own making, a record that fought so hard to avoid the difficult second album cliche that it created a whole bunch of identity problems for itself along the way. On the other hand, it's a showcase of confidence and ambition from the band, one that proved marketable to a global audience, and all in the face of a rather overproduced sound and a wholesale lack of Runaway. Come on, Runaway is an incredible song, let's be honest. So is Talking Corners good? Well, I'll get back to you. Is it worth a revisit? Absolutely, without question. It's a fascinating record for many, many reasons. The kind of thing you can throw on and really enjoy, stop and kind of say, maybe that's a bit dated, and also kind of wonder, was this as good as I thought it was at the time? Is it even better now? Does it hold up? It raises all kinds of questions, and that's what we're here to do in the revisit. And to be fair, as I say, That's one of the best opening tracks I've heard on a record by pretty much anybody.
So, what do we all think of that?
Well, I think that this is a surprise that it was in the shortlist for me. And it stole some places, I have to say. At least
not resentful at all.
No. I think that I was surprised how many songs I knew in it. They were absolutely massive at the time, and I think there were seven singles off this album. Yeah. Weirdly, as Dave
couldn't
mentioned,
couldn't get away from them. Yeah.
Mm. Weirdly, as Dave mentioned, there was an initial album which was released and did fine, and then there was a year later there was a new album released, you know, a new version of the album with Dreams on it, which is the Tintin Out remix, which is really weird in this album, because the album became the album that you hear now is the album is the second version, and it has lots and lots of the songs are remixed. They have strange kind of trip-hoppy kind of beats underneath them, Tintin Out and Todd Terry and all this kind of stuff, and it's a really odd album. It doesn't hang together very well, I don't think. It kind of sounds at times like one of those Dance to Tipperary albums where they have dance music over trad. It's just kind of jarring, you know.
Production is ropey, yeah. It is.
But I think that the thing about the production is the production is everywhere. It's so produced. Mm. It's so slick. It's so sweet. Their voices sound amazing. The harmonies are perfect. They're like beautiful robots singing beautifully in time. You know, it's too perfect, you know. And but the funny thing is I listened to some of the tracks on YouTube because, you know, I can't listen to Spotify on my phone anywhere. So I listened to tracks on YouTube, and the tracks on YouTube are less produced. Like, for example, the So Young version, which I think, as Dave said, about Bewitched, it is kind of almost a girl band song. But the version that's on YouTube doesn't have the weird kind of repeated vocals that the version on the album does. And, you know, I'd like to hear that album a lot more.
Mm. I think, like, Dave kind of captured it quite well. It's like something like this, you know, what is a good album? Like, I think he kind of says, like, it isn't a great album, but there's something about it. I think even like with Kieran saying that he could remember so many songs off it, that speaks to longevity of the actual songwriting itself. And an album can be like the meeting point of, you know, production and songwriting as well. And some records maybe deserve to be remembered, but aren't. And I think when you're looking back at something like this, you have to say, well, why was this successful? Why did people listen to it? And I think it's almost an artifact now to listen to. I don't think it would be successful at all now. I think it'd be quite quaint, as you were saying. I think it's interesting to listen to in the sense that it is so pristine and so perfect and so crafted and so much time and everything else. When you listen to pop music now, which I think has its own aesthetic, is completely the opposite end of it. It's not as pristine. It's not as worked on in the same way. There's a lot of kind of, and I have no problem with it, but there is a lot of kind of sing the song, auto-tune it, do what you want. Like, as you say, like, a lot of the backing vocals are perfect, but they're actually performed that way. There's a lot of craft, in my view.
I get that. I mean,
in my view, that's gone into it. That makes it stand out for me. And I think with anything, like, how you remember a record like this is through the singles, because it's not supposed to be Sgt. Pepper's or anything like that. It's supposed to be a collection of songs. Here is band. Give it to you. And I think that's interesting that a manufactured band, or, well, they weren't obviously their family, but like the manufactured music and the way that it was done in such a pristine and kind of interesting way to me. I think that was what drew me to it. I have to say, with the other records, apart from obviously one or two, I was listening to them, but I didn't feel any sort of like, okay, this is kind of indie by numbers, you know, this is paint by numbers, whatever. And with this, it was by the numbers, but it's so well done.
I think longevity is the key there, though, because, I mean, that's... The Corrs are one of the few Irish bands that could really lay claim to having more than two or three songs in the popular Irish music songbook, really. And this record, you know, it doesn't have Runaway, like, you know, it doesn't have that. But, you know, those songs that stay with you, I think So Young is a great song. And again, listening to it, you're kind of remembering them all again. And like, yeah, you know, you're right. They were so big. Like, they were so giant. And this album was so popular that it pulled their first record back into the chart. And so the Corrs became the first band since the Beatles to have an album at one and two.
And Runaway was re-released as well.
Yeah.
After this, remixed again by Tintin Out. It was obviously
Tintin Out, like, did they did a, speaking of the Spice Girls, Tintin Out did Emma Bunton's first solo single.
He did, which yes, Throw Me in the Shallow Water. What I Am is What I Am.
What I am is what I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Edie Brickell song. Huh? Did she cover that?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think it went to number one as well.
It did, yeah.
God damn it, Tintin there.
Yeah. So throwing out the hits.
Next show, is he Irish?
Do they do Here's Where the Story Ends, that one?
Oh, I think they might have as well. Yeah, yeah.
God, that's all I can hear. I can think I remember that. That's mental. It's mental how much stuff you can remember when it's played to you, like audio memories as opposed to like,
yeah.
I couldn't tell you what I did for half the year, but I could tell you. Someone play a song and go, oh, I remember that.
So let's move on to our next album, which
you notice I stayed very, very quiet.
Well, you're going to have to talk now.
Okay.
The next album is Butterfly Effect by Sack, which sounds a bit like this.
I wish in a way I'd given myself a bit more time to really get to know it, because there's a lot of songs on it. There's 14 tracks on the album, and I feel like I didn't quite get under the skin of all of them, but I knew quite a number of the tracks from seeing the band live over the year, and I think that says something about the strength of the material, that they're a really strong live band, and I think that's maybe a big part of my affection for Sack. I'm more familiar with them as a live band than as a recorded band. And I have a particular fondness for Martin McCann as a front person, both, you know, in a live capacity and as a singer. So I'm waffling a little bit, but I think it's a really strong album. I think it might be a tiny bit over long. I feel a little bit funny about making any critical remarks about it, because I know some of the people involved in the band who are still involved in music. But if I'm honest, I think it probably could have been at least two tracks shorter. I think it might have made a crisper listen. My favourite tracks, I have a few favourite tracks, but my absolute favourite is Laughter Lines, which I think was the first song I properly heard by Sack. I vaguely remember hearing the single they released, I think, in 1994, which was What Do the Christians Ever Do For Us? Mm. That was the first thing they ever put out.
I didn't realise that was such a hit or whatever. It was NME's like Song of the Week and Melody Maker and all this kind of...
It seemed to sort of give them a head of steam. And they signed to a label called Lemon at the time. I'm not aware of who they were or how big that label was.
That's not U2's label or anything, is it?
I don't think so.
No.
But... then that label collapsed, as a lot of them did, and they were dropped and moved on to another label for this album. And I don't think the album did as well as I guess it was hoped it would do. I think there was a lot of expectation behind the band, especially because, well, actually, it was after this album came out that Morrissey picked up on them and brought them out on tour for a couple of his tours. He was a big fan. I still hold Martin McCann up as being one of my favourite singers and front people. And I still go and see Sack when they play.
He's a great DJ as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. And that's the thing. I mean, I think it's kind of an aside, but it was interesting to me to look at the overall list of quite a fairly diverse range of artists and musicians who were listed on the longer list that we all got before we narrowed it down to our own favourites. And quite a significant number of them are either still together in the original guise or are in some shape or form still involved in music in quite an integral way. And sometimes it's on the production side of things. Sometimes it's in, you know, being involved in event management or things like that. But most of them still get out and play, which is, I think, says a lot, because there's some sad stories along the way, you know. We all have disappointments too, so.
I think you're right about that song, Laughter Lines. A couple of songs on it that I really liked. The one thing has struck me with this album, I found it, I, I, you, you, the first couple of times I listened to it, I just got nothing from it.
It's quite dense. And it's very guitar-y.
This is very, isn't it?
Too guitar heavy as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very guitar-y. Yeah. And
I think you have to kind of wait for the songs to land on you a little bit. It's a production and arrangement thing.
Yeah, it's a grower, I suppose, is what I would say. It's a grower, not a shower. So yeah, it just took a long time to get to know it. And then when I did get to know it, it came out and I started to really like it. And I kind of dismissed it a little bit. I think I said, you know, I listened to it and I was like, okay, it's like this. And I was already kind of formulating what I was going to say. And then the more I listened to it, the more certain songs kind of came through. And as you said, it kind of started to show itself. One thing is, it's there's so little of it online. If I type in butterfly effect, if I wanted to find
information, you mean?
Yeah, there was a film with Ashton Kutcher in it or something from whenever, and it's just all about that, you know. And
yeah,
like it was actually really hard to find any more about them. I thought it sounded like the Boo Radleys, and I thought it sounded like Morrissey, and he toured. They toured with Boo Radleys.
And both of those bands, but they described themselves and. It's on like press releases, and it's been in the said an interview as Frank Sinatra fronting the Pixies, which I don't think is a bad description, actually. Mm. You know, because I think Martin McCann is a really strong, good crooner. You know, I don't think they sound like Pixies, really.
Yeah, I don't get the Pixies from
not really. I think closer. Boo Radley's is probably closer.
And Morrissey, it's very Morrissey influenced too.
There's a song called Shop Soiled, and it's so Morrissey.
It's quite Morrissey.
And there's another song called Blood Lover, and I think it's like halfway through. I think you're right about that. It's a little bit long.
I think if it had been a bit more economical as a record, I think the stronger songs would have really, you know, helped. I think they would have popped more. Songs like Angel, like why they didn't open the album with that. Because it's straight in, no guitars.
Fun fact about Sack, John Burton is pretty much responsible for my journalism career.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
was the guitarist?
Yeah. John was booking bands in the Hub when it first opened in Tampa Bar, and I was writing music reviews for their new website, which was very innovative at the time, for a beer. And John was writing for the Event Guide, and he was stopping writing for them, and they needed one person to write, do all of the music stuff for it. And John told the editor, Kieran Owens, to get me to do it. And so John told me this. I was like, oh my God, amazing. And that's how I started writing in print. So there
it's
you go.
Fault.
Thanks, John.
I have to say with the record, I think it's interesting that you kind of mirrored it in a way, Kieran. Like when I was listening to it, when I review anything for the last mixtape, I like to kind of listen to it maybe once or twice. I walk away and I'll try to think of what I can remember. It's kind of like when you go to a gig, I don't take notes or anything like that. I can never understand people who did. What I would do is on my walk home, I'd try to think of the things that stuck out to me, because that's the stuff you remember, so that must be the most important stuff, be they good or bad. And with this record, I couldn't for the life of me think what was sticking out at me. Like it was so, and maybe it's the length of it, maybe it's such a long time sitting with it, but nothing stuck out really as that's the song that I think the record's made on, or that's the kind of the theme of it. It sounded quite indie for the time that it was. And I think that I didn't actually listen to them at the time. So I feel that had I listened to them in 1997, I would have really enjoyed it. But looking back at it from 2017, it didn't really make that impression. Not to be the kind of the guy who did it.
For me listening to it, it kind of, shows how guitars have really disappeared from music.
Because
when you're, like you're saying, very guitar, when you're listening to this, it's all guitar. It's all, and you're thinking, God, like, I just don't. Or they're just far less prominent. I think, music and rock music or indie music, everything has become far more separated and its own entity. And this is very much this big wave.
It's a wall of guitar.
Of guitar sound. So I think it's very much of the time as well.
Very much of the time.
That's interesting as well, Una. Like, I think there was a time in between that record and now where we were almost apologetic about having guitars in indie music. Kaiser Chiefs and stuff like that, the guitars like way in the background and don't pay any attention to it, you know what I mean? So maybe that might be part of it, that we kind of overdosed
the guitar.
It's
definitely a different way of listening, I think. And I think context is kind of important. And probably, it definitely hugely influenced my choice, because there's a certain, I suppose it's not nostalgia, but I definitely have a relationship from the time with that music.
Mm.
And have a particular affection for the band. Mm. And it's a lot of that is from seeing them live and from loving them as a live entity. So maybe, you know, I kind of shook the rules a little bit because I didn't, okay. I didn't go 100% for the best.
We'll see you
album
at the committee meeting tomorrow.
It's arguable that, you know, I probably could have put the Frank and Walters higher on the list because it may be
dangling that in front of him, like.
But I will, yeah, it's funny. One thing that I did think from it is it's very confident. I thought it was a confident album.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I felt like I don't know Martin McCann, and I watched the video and. I watched a video for one of the songs, is Latitude, which is, I think, probably my favourite. And I just thought he was so unlikely or something. He just didn't sound like the voice, you know?
Yeah.
And I found, and he doesn't sing in the video until halfway through. And I was like,
right,
is
that the singer?
You know?
He is unlike his voice, yeah, in a way. He's, as a frontman, he's got this sort of like a half clownish and half bullish attitude on stage. Yeah. So he's sort of winking at you, not literally winking at you, but, you know, sort of in attitude, he's winking at you, but also at the same time, you wouldn't fuck with him, you know. And I love that. I really like that.
That's cool.
Mm. I only read one thing about Sack online, one piece, and it said that they were allergic to success. And I just thought,
you could say that about so many people.
Yeah, but I was just thinking, though, but as well, like, I kind of liked, not that I liked, but I liked that how confident the album was. It was like, it was just like, as if it was like like you said, a fuck you to success, you know?
Mm.
I mean, like the reality of you know, every band is, there's always a thought about that. But if you can still make music that lasts and it's completely independent of whether or not it was successful or not. Like a lot of these albums, you know, like you're not going to look at the sales of them to see whether they're good or not, you know, because it doesn't matter now, you know? Mm. And I think especially with that one, like, I've no idea how many albums it sold. I've no idea how big they were. Yeah, I've no idea. But still, there's just a confidence within it. And yeah, as I said, it grew on me as the kind of, you know, 2 weeks kind of went on. I really kind of,
okay,
I became much more into it. Actually, it wasn't even 2 weeks. It was the last kind of 5 days, sorry. Mm. The other albums I listened to do, but that I didn't, it wasn't on my original list. But then when I got it, yeah, so over the course of the 5 days that I listened to it, yeah, it grew on me.
All right, well, I suppose seeing as we're talking about so many guitars, let's move on to David Holmes. And let's listen to a track from his album, Let's Get Killed. By David Holmes. And Una, you had some thoughts on this album.
Yeah, this was my choice. I think just because I hadn't listened to it in so long, and going back to the album, if you're looking at, obviously with hindsight, you can kind of figure out what is more innovative than the other things around it. And really, this record really holds up, you know. It sounds like, it does sound of the time in the kind of you know, the mainstreaming of softer kind of techno-y, breakbeat-y kind of bits. I suppose most typified by like Moby or someone like that. But then also in like the samples, the spoken samples, the conversation samples and that kind of stuff, which kind of sounds a little bit cliche. But actually, it's a really, it's a really interesting album. Like, you can really sit down and listen to it. And so I was kind of really enjoying it, and I was, I suppose, natural with David Holmes that it is kind of telling this story or setting this place and time, which is, you know, New York, and, you know, is going to be cinematic. The dude, you know, writes film scores, all that kind of stuff. But there's something, although it completely stands up and feels, you know, quite contemporary, it is very much a point in time as well. Like, when you're listening to it, you're like, that is mid to late 90s, you know, someone experimenting with electronic music, but trying to make it quite scory. And, you know, Holmes is an absolute innovator. You know, he's always in the background doing his thing. And I just really enjoyed listening to the album. I really enjoyed it, and was reading up about it afterwards, and the conversation bits that he recorded to use for those like little samples and stuff. Like he had them for 10 years, you know, and was kind of looking for something to do with them. And
he recorded them when he was 17.
Yeah,
I mean that's some forward thinking shit right
there. Yeah, totally. And also just that idea that, you know, this is a music made by an Irish artist or artist from Belfast. It doesn't and didn't sound like anything else at the time, apart from maybe pop. And it's so outside of Ireland. You know, it's so outward looking. It's all about, you know, these weird jazzy bits, these weird break beats, these weird trip hoppy bits, obviously very much of the time as well. There's an energy to it that is not Belfast, but also kind of is. And it feels very sophisticated. And I just kind of thought, yeah, maybe that was the best Irish album of 1997 in retrospect. Those are my thoughts.
Cool. Let's open it up to the panel.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I wasn't familiar with the record before listening to it, but I really enjoyed it. And it was a close third for me listening to it. I'm glad it actually made it in as well.
Mm.
So we could talk about it, because I think you're right there. Probably the most interesting thing is that it was an Irish album made in 1997 and doesn't sound like an Irish album made in 1997.
Yeah.
It sounds like it could have been made anywhere. It could have been made in New York, Berlin, anywhere like that. Yeah. And that kind of forward thinking. What kind of got me about it too is the way how kind of cubist it is with the music. It kind of like cuts and pastes, and like things are thrown in at other, like there's very sharp angles to the entire record.
Yeah.
And it kind of moves in that way. So you're not entirely sure what's coming around the corner. And I think that's how it keeps your interest, because you need to with an album like that, where there's not, let's say, a hook or a chorus coming up. You need to keep people's interest for a very long period of time. I think that's what he does. It's cinematic in that way.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed it, listening to it. And it was, I think, of the few here that I didn't know, it was definitely the one I was like, after we do this, I'll go back and listen to it a hell of a lot more, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I need to go back and check it out more as well. Because I think, I wouldn't say it passed me by at the time, but definitely it felt, even though I was aware he was an Irish artist from the north of Ireland, from Belfast. He's from Belfast, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
That it didn't feel like he was. It felt like he was from somewhere else. You know, that's not a criticism. That's just it's as if I didn't relate to him in the way that I related to other Irish artists around me.
Dark and ominous, though, as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like I was surprised. I was actually surprised how much I had got into it, because I sometimes with these kind of albums, like DJ albums, where there's, like guest singers, or it's kind of, you know, 8 minute long songs with a bit of dubstep in it. I just kind of went into it thinking I wasn't going to be into it, but I loved all the little stories. There's one little short one, 5 or 6 in. I don't have it written down the name of it, and it's a guy, and he does a kind of a rap, and at the end he's like, "Okay, man, keep in touch with me, you know, tell me how the album's going, or whatever." And when he said, it's just something that made me laugh, you know, and like I was really kind of into all the little snippets and all the little things,
and it's really human,
yeah,
you know, and it is very tactile, and you can feel yourself in the, like, you know, close your eyes, listen to this album, and you can see the like rubbish pouring out of the wire bin and the Lower East Side, and the lights coming off the puddles. And I mean, you're very much in it. Like,
yeah, it's very urban. It's very urban.
And it's just very evocative, I think. You know, the first track is called Listen, you know, and it's less than a minute long. And really, it's kind of this command that compels you to be like, okay, I'm going to go on a journey with this. And yeah, I was kind of surprised that I liked it. And I mean, it was a big album. It charted in the US, maybe up in the 20s or 30s or something like that. So he did a good job.
And also, a lot of songs are, I recognize a lot of the tracks from ads, I think.
Yeah.
There's definitely
a lot of syncing going on.
Gritty Shaker is one of them. Is definitely in some sort of car ad or whatever. Mm.
I think the use of the voices, the fact that they are recorded, almost found sounds, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's not a rapper,
it's not
exactly field recording. Exactly. So there's a variety in the voices, but they're very connected to the place that they come from, and they're very conversational. And there's a great one where it's a guy giving out basically about not being able to dance at a club. I don't know which track it is, but I really enjoyed that, you know, and it's as you say, it puts you completely in that place, or you imagine the whole scene, you know. It was a natural movement for him to move into soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
I think it throws up different things every time you listen to it as well. I think, like you're saying, there's different moments and different bits of conversation that appear throughout the record that you probably don't get the first time.
Yeah.
You get the second or third. So I think it's one of those ones that kind of throws up something every once in a while.
Yeah, I couldn't, at the start, before kind of, like, I try and listen to the albums first before I go investigating them, because I think it's more interesting just to kind of come cold. And I didn't know, I thought they were bits of films, you know? But then, because they were so rambly, all the little stories, I thought they couldn't be parts of films. Like, there's one guy and he's like listening off the drugs that he's taken.
That's right.
The state that he's in. And I was just kind of going like, what film could this be from? You know, like, it's so bizarre. But then, I really liked it. Now, the only thing about it was I think and maybe you just said, I can't remember what name it was. I don't know the names of anything because of the songs on it, they don't necessarily...
No, it's not about that, really.
But it's like they're pieces as opposed to like songs, and so as a result, it suits a kind of a listen. It isn't very, you know, it's not very malleable, sort of. You know, like for example, I often put my headphones in and I walk around with my daughter in the buggy and listen to this like New York street scenes and stuff. I think I would just find it a bit weird.
Yeah.
Whereas on the train on the way in. I wanted to write down the names of the songs because I didn't write any names. I was listening to the songs and it's just on the train. It was amazing going on the train, past Dollymount, you know, Strand.
It's like, a particular atmosphere.
And I think that kind of restricts it slightly because I felt like I needed to be in the buzz for it a bit more. Like, I had to go towards the album.
What would you normally listen to walking along wheeling the buggy?
Oh, well, actually, I listen to podcasts.
Oh, well, there you go.
But I listen to music when I'm driving and stuff like that. And, and then
I think it'd be great driving music.
Yeah, I think driving, movement, that kind of stuff.
It's very, I don't know, it's very nighttime. It's very, it's also quite, you know, it is a very metropolitan album. Like, it's super city-based. You can hear the... You know, I don't know.
It's not for walking children in nature.
Yeah, it's not really. You can hear the grid network of the streets in Manhattan. You know, you can hear all of those things. And
I think it's kind of interesting to me, not having listened to it tons, but having, you know, and actually initially when I started listening to it, I was dipping in and out of the tracks to kind of get a flavor of, which I wouldn't normally do. I think it's because probably, you know, we've been taking a bit of license because they're instrumental, you know, in a way, because it's not listening to a narrative as such. But I found when I was doing that, I think it's quite, as an album, I think the palette of sounds is quite limited. And I don't know whether that was deliberate or whether it was just whatever was to hand and whatever it was dictated by, you know, software, plugins, who knows? I don't know what he was using from that time. But I actually think that probably works to its advantage in a lot of ways.
You're dead right about that. Like, it is that kind of limited palette, even though it does feel
it's very much of a piece.
Yeah. Also, Gem from Oasis played.
That was my fact. That was my fact. Gem from Oasis, yeah.
Gem from Oasis.
He played on Radio 7.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you are.
There you are.
It's a big year for Oasis in Midway.
Well, let's turn our attention to another band that had their sights set stateside, and this is U2 and Pump. You got perfume, but you Discotheque by U2 and Stephen, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, well, I suppose like when I was listening to the records and when I got like the list, I was really happy to see this because I always want to talk about this record because it's an absolute hot mess of a record and it's fantastic for it. If you look at U2 at the time, it's coming off the back of like Octung Baby, which is this absolute monumental record, and then Zuperd, which follows it, which is an understated record. And I think kind of an underrated one as well has Stay Far Away So Close, which I think more people should actually listen to. So you have these two kind of almost buzzing with the change of, you know, the analog to digital age, which I think that's what Octone Baby is, you know, and it's the real invention of U2 changing themselves from the probably the more monolithic sound of Joshua Tree and moving into the more kind of European industrial kind of almost techno electronic based sounds of Octone Baby. You come then to pop, which is absolutely which is absolutely, like, you know, actually buzzes and kind of fuzzes and fizzes around, and it really reaches, it's probably their, like, their last hurrah stylistically to me, because what follows it is All That You Can't Leave Behind, which is all sorts of colours of beige and very vanilla and very safe and very apologetic for pop, almost like, we're really, really sorry, we overdosed, it was too excessive, we went too far. But that's actually what I like about it as a record. You know, you have Mofo, that sounds like, like, you know, the throwaway track of a Jason Bourne movie. So I'm trying to not hit the table now, I'm moving my hands up in the air.
Sit
on my hands or something like that. You know, you have like this big riff rock of a, you know, a discotheque. Everything about the album, they throw this. And it's not a pretty production, and it doesn't really work, but it's actually trying to do something. And I think with some of these records, there wasn't the point where I'm going, I can see what you're trying to do. And this is at the point for me when U2 were still trying to do that. They were still trying to capture something. They're still trying to move forward. You know, Bono, to me, and I know this is probably a controversial thing to say, is probably one of the great frontmen of all time, which would be, in certain people would go very mad when they hear that. But he is, I think, you know, the Mephisto character, everything about him. And I think this is when they... It also has a sense of humour about themselves. You know, Discotheque, the video had a sense of humour about itself as well. Like, the problem with it is that, like, songs like Staring at the Sun, which is a beautiful song, but it's kind of pelted with this production that just goes at the background, you know, where it has edge with a guitar sound throughout the entire record, which is great. I love the guitar sound. And to me, Edge is one of the great guitarists. He's one of those guitarists like Johnny Marr. Johnny Marr could really, like, he was the guitarist for the Smiths. You couldn't have anyone else playing guitar for the Smiths but Johnny Marr. Same for the Edge and you too. Now, the guitars are more, you know, processed than cat food on pop. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Like, it's interesting to listen to. And what I think is good about this record is that it's the type of record that tries, and it tries so hard and it reaches so far, but fails in so many levels. But that's kind of the interest. I'd rather listen to a record that tries and fails instead of sit still and you know achieve something. There are some certain bands around now that I'd love to name do that, you know, and you're just like, do something. But like with U2, at least at this point, I know why people, like, in, you know, recent albums have been a bit bitty, but for me this is like so hyper stylized that you can't help but smile at how hard they're trying. And I think it's such a shame that after that, the, you know, they kind of become, as I say, a little bit apologetic. Like, and I think I like a couple of songs on All That You Can't Leave Behind, but for me, you know, the opening with Discotheque, with that kind of whirling guitar and everything that follows it, is just this massive, like, I mean, I don't know, I don't think they were on anything at the time, but it just sounds like, you know, the height of the party, where All That You Can't Leave Behind is kind of the bit where you're like ringing up your friends apologizing for what you've done. So, yeah, I think that's why for me, you know, like a lot of records, like, you know, give you Pink Floyd as an example, you know, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon is probably perfect, okay? It's not my favorite Pink Floyd album, but I know it's their best. My favorite Pink Floyd album is The Wall, which is also a hot mess and very flawed and just very long and very bloated. And this record as well is kind of bloated. It's not my favorite U2 record. That's Supra. Everybody should listen to Supra. But pop is like that, is that kind of record that I think, you know, it's kind of like when you listen to some, like, I'll give you an example. Foo Fighters. Can't stand Foo Fighters. And they would never make a record like this because they don't have it in them to be that creative, because it's so by the numbers. This isn't by the numbers, and that's why it kind of fails in a lot of ways, but I'd rather see that in a record.
I think this is the first time I've ever heard somebody speak passionately about you too. great.
It's a hot mess is the best description of this album, I think. This is the album that got me into you too. Which is weird. Because, yeah, it was like 97, I was 14. And the 98, they released the best of, the first part of the best of, 1980 to 1990. Okay. And that's, I actually got into YouTube properly from the best of, which is super lame. But
that's how
of
I got
me.
Into Smashing Pumpkins, actually.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, with a band who had a load of
like,
albums.
It's really, pop as an album is actually like, it kind of twists your neck a bit. It's not very pleasant to listen to. You know, it's kind of an affront. But no, there, and even like, you know, Bono's enunciation and the snarl and the sneer and all that kind of stuff, you know, is not very pleasant. Like, they're not like welcoming you into something. But I think that's kind of why it's good. And it also, it has Wake Up Dead Man on it, right? Wake Up Dead Man is one of U2's best songs. You know, it is, really
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. I think it's one of my, I think it's my favourite. It's also the
it
only...
It could be a Radiohead tune or something. Like, it's really odd.
He swear a word in a U2 song as well. He says...
Is that right?
Yeah, he says, fucked. He says, fucked.
Do you say it like that?
Yeah, yeah. A fucked up world it is too. Yeah, which is mad when you think about you too. But I think that everything that Stephen said was right, and everything. Yeah, it's. I think it's not as cheesy sometimes, because Bono is very earnest, and that's why a lot of people like what he does. But sometimes it can kind of go across the line a little bit into cheesiness, and it isn't as. I don't think this is. I mean, it still has God Will Send His Angels, which is. Very cheesy song, but then the counterpoint to a song about God, which is very cheesy, is "Wake Up Dead Man," which is which just seems so honest. You know, I think
"Wake Up Dead Man" is kind of an echo for me for "All I Want Is You." Mm. Like, there's kind of a line there that can be traced in a song that is actually, even though there's cliche in it, it is actually, you can sense the truth in it and the honesty, and it's extraordinarily open. And it's so weird that that track is actually on this album, because the whole thing is so sarcastic and so 90s, right? I mean, it's like literally like could be the Eurotrash soundtrack.
Yeah.
And, it's super cynical and, air quotes, a lot of air quotes.
I don't know. I think I agree with that. I think the worst songs are like that. But I think there's like Mofo.
Mofo's great.
And Gone, I think.
Gone is fantastic.
But I think they're all pretty honest. I take them as being honest songs in the hot mess of the album.
Yeah.
And like, for example, I can't, like, Discotheque, while it's a good single and everything, I don't really want to listen to Discotheque, you know?
Mm. Oh, I would.
Yeah. Well, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, when you're like, you know what I'd like right now is a
bit of Discotheque.
Ham cheese toasty and a bit of Discotheque. You know, it's not going to, I just can't see it. But whereas, this is the first U2 album I bought, and I didn't know what to make of it, I guess, at the time. And I the cover is horrible. It's the worst cover of any album. This shiny thing with this, it's horrible. And but I think that's it. It's like, this is the last time that U2 were trying really hard to be weird, you know. And I. Like, whatever happened around, you know, after, you know, Rattling on Home, they made two great albums, Zooropa.
It's as if they left America and found Zoopera. Europe.
That's what I was saying.
Zoopera.
Zooropa, yeah.
I was going, what is that? That's the cool way of saying it. I'm not cool. But, it's really good. But the weird thing about this album is I think it's weird. This is their ninth album. But it's the eighth or ninth biggest selling one, you know. Everything before this sold tons, you know, and then this happened.
You can absolutely see why what happened afterwards. Do you know what I mean? Like, this kind
album
of attempt.
After this is one of their biggest since. It's massive. Like,
I ended up at the Grammys and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's like a pity that it is a they took a risk with this record, and I suppose they took a risk with the song. Songs of Innocence or whatever as well, in a way, their last one. But yeah, the divilment, often literally, like Bono with the horns and all that kind of stuff, and the real just very kind of European outlook disappeared from U2, I think, after this album.
Yeah, they spent a few years in America in love with America, and then they came back to Europe and fell in love with Berlin, and then I don't know what happened.
I think they just went home.
But they were on a mad trajectory, because you had Acton Baby, which was, you know, obviously a reaction to the kind of slope that went all the way up from Unforgettable Fire, then up again, more American to Joshua Tree, then more American again to Rattling on Home. And then suddenly they just cut it all down and started again. And they went in this kind of, I'll say it again, it's kind of a slope from Acton Baby to Zoopera. And then again up, you know, a bit odder to pop, and then they went and they did Passengers, and Passengers was so weird that they
bought the garage and they hung a Trabant upside down on it.
Correct.
But then, you know what I mean, and then
album was recorded in Dublin though as well, like most of their others, you know.
And as well, apparently it was they were still recording it until the last couple of days. They booked a tour.
Always a good sign.
Yeah. Always a good sign. And before that, they had to delay because I read this. One of the reasons there's so much kind of electronic stuff in is because Larry Mullen was really, his back was really badly injured and he couldn't be there for the first 3 months. But he was really angry at the band for starting without him. But Edge was like, we're going for it. And then he was like, hey, you know, you can't go for it. So he left his rehab early to get back into it, and then he did himself a damage, and then he was out for another. So they had to stop the whole thing. So it's really interesting because what happened was Howie B was making the, you know, doing the I don't know the beats.
Yeah, it was just weird. So who was it? It was Howie B and Flood and Osborne, Steve Osborne, was it?
I know the first two, and there was another guy, and he left halfway through. And then wasn't credited on the album, and there was some stuff about that or whatever. I mean, this is just like stuff, like this is like basic stuff. This is like Wikipedia stuff, just to get myself some background. But, you know.
It's interesting. It's probably, it's the first record that they don't have Brian Eno on for quite some time as well.
And then did they go back to Eno for all the...
Did Eno do Rattle and Hum? No, he didn't.
No.
I don't think so.
I think he did Octum Baby.
He did,
of Zooropa, apparently. and obviously Joshua Tree and The Unforgettable Fire, but... I don't think of the studio albums. I don't think.
I think it's, you know, I think it's a brave move to move away from the producer you've worked with for a long time. Mm. You know, who's produced million selling albums, and I think all of that stuff for a band the size of U2 has to be massively commended.
Yeah.
I think. I agree. Album wise, I think you could take off 3 or 4 songs that, like the Playboy Mansion and Miami and stuff like that, like winking at the camera while you're kind of doing finger guns and stuff like that, that Bono is doing. I any of that stuff I'm not into, and the overly cloying stuff not into. But the best stuff here, I think, is some of their best stuff. Really,
like for me, like the question is: are there many bands who would be number one now? You know, rock bands, I'd say, of the moment that would take that risk. That would do that. That would be self-effacing. That would be self-knowing.
Well, there's a couple of types of risks, though, here. And I think one of them is it's their 9th album. Mm. You can do it on your 9th album, whereas you mightn't do it on your 2nd. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like,
well, it's also a concept album, kind of, you know, in a way. Like, it's creating a specific aesthetic. It's very much inventing a sound for them. Obviously not inventing a sound, but, like, going, okay... We, you know, threw all the ideas in the hat and Edge picked, it's going to be a dirty pop kind of, you know, loads of programmed drums and everything in it. So that's what we're going to do, you know. And as you said, that's commendable. Like they went and did that. I mean, could you see The National doing that? Or, you know, like it's they did it and with, you know, mixed results. But I mean, I wouldn't really go back and listen to pop, to be honest. I'd always return to U2's more kind of majestic and emotional crying songs.
I think though, just the question is whether or not is it a great album?
I think for me, like I think I say yes in the sense of like maybe it's just a temperament on my part, but I don't like Pristine and I don't like Boring and I don't like By the Numbers, and for me, this record kind of ticks a lot of those boxes. It's not the greatest album of all time. It's certainly not. I don't think, as you say, I don't even think it's in probably the top 3 or 4 of their best albums or anything like that. But I think, for me, sometimes it goes beyond what's actually on the record and what people are trying to do. And that's what interests me.
Great. All right. Well, moving on. Our last album of this episode is Horse of a Different Colour by The Revenants. Baby wants to marry money. She's tired of costs and bills, tired of lying to credit from mother, reminding her what's real. Baby's tired of trams and trains, small change and lies and fairness. Baby wants something silent and German. That was Marry Money by The Revenants. Aaron.
Hello. So my album was The Revenants, Horse of a Different Colour. First album by this band, but actually not the first album, by the singer Stephen Ryan, who used to be in Stars of Heaven and I think went on to be in the Dinah Brand. It is a very American sounding album. It is very, there's a lot of R.E.M. in there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a funny mix because it kind of sounds like it's very, there's a lot of It's a lot of focus put on the vocals and the lyrics, and a lot of focus put on the guitar. But the rest of it is quite functional. It's quite professional. It sounds good. But the bass and drums, it's not a super inventive album. It's kind of, I don't mean that in a negative way. That's just not what it does. It is just about the songs and the lyrics and the feelings that come from that. And also a couple of songs, Eileen from the Woodbees sings. So it's kind of, it sounds like an album that was constructed over a couple of years. It was recorded on an 8-track. So I can imagine that it took a long time to do. And it kind of sounds a little bit like that. But when it's good, it's really strong. There's a couple of tracks. Merry Money, track 3, Ted's Tune, I think it's called. And a song called Capercaillie. I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Capercaillie, I think.
Zuropa.
Zupra. But yeah, so like when it's good, it's really good, and it's really kind of, I think it's kind of atmospheric, and it really makes you feel. There's a picture. The picture of the cover is like a horse in a field, like kind of abandoned or something. And there's something about that which kind of, it really works for it. It does feel like it was written in a, you know, in a shed in the middle of a field, you know, in the poor south of America or something. It's funny the way that is, but I really liked it initially, and as it went on, I didn't feel it had the depth to keep me, sort of, you know. It didn't unfurl into this beautiful album, I suppose, but I think it's a strong album. The first track, Let's Get Falling Down, is my least favourite track. It annoys me, but so I had to kind of listen to that less as it went on. But I think it's really good. And as I said, there's a lot of really, really nice guitar on it. It's nearly the star of the album for me. The second last track, I can't remember what the name of it is now, but it's got this gorgeous guitar, and it's got a really, really gorgeous feel to it. But the lyrics are just a repeated line. I can't remember what the line is, but I don't know. It's a funny album. I'm interested to see what everyone else says. But one thing, Jeff Travis, who was with Rough Trade, who signed Stars of Heaven and then I think signed The Revenants later, he said that it was his one regret that Stephen Ryan wasn't massive, you know. Mm. And Dave Fanning wrote this piece that he said that he has seen hundreds of thousands of bands, 50 a year for the last whatever. How old is Dave Fanning?
95.
50 years. And he said that when they did the roller coaster tour in the late 90s, they did this roller coaster tour around Ireland where he played colleges, I suppose. And they played 11 dates. And the best band at every date was The Revenants. But they were always first on because they had to leave and get back to Dublin so they could get up for their day jobs, you know? Mm. And it's funny, like, that is just so much of being in a band, you know, in that. It just said so much, you know? And I don't know, there's something sort of a bit melancholic about it as well. It's, you know, about that was what they were doing. When we were talking with Sack, I was saying how that was, you know, a kind of a confident record.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of a confident record, but in a different way in this. It's kind of like, this is what we're doing, you know, and it doesn't seem to be, it's not influenced by anybody else. I think it's probably the most different out of all these ones that are here. You know, it's not super produced. It really needs a lot of backing vocals at times. You know, I feel like there could have been much more playing of it as a band, and maybe it was written, you know, pieced together. But yeah, it's a funny one. I think it's a strong album. I think it could have been a lot stronger. And that's just what I think. Yeah.
It's interesting, like you were saying, like there could have been more backing vocals and things like that. It's a rather charming record, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I think part of the charm is in how kind of, you know, makeshift it is, kind of patchwork. And I think there's a lot of, as you say, I think there's one band that came to my mind, Lemonheads, when I was listening to
it. Yeah, okay. Actually, that's a fair, yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah, there's that kind of jangle to it, that early 90s kind of feel. So I think, like, and I wasn't aware of, you know, the background to it before Kieran was kind of talking about it there. So it makes sense in a way that it is that charming. And it's also quite impressive, considering, you know what I mean? And I think it was a band that, again, just at the time would have passed me by completely. I wasn't aware of them. But it was a record listening to it for this that I was kind of pleased I did. Because, you know, I think it is a record, and you rarely try to say anything like this because I don't think anything is deserving of anything. But it is a record that you feel like should be listen to more, or at least a band that should be kind of talked about more.
Revisited, perhaps?
I used to go and see the Stars of Heaven, and I did see The Revenants a few times.
How far before before Stars of Heaven, War of the Revenants?
Because, I mean, I saw the Stars of Heaven a couple of times when I was barely old enough to go to gigs. And I saw the Revenants, I was probably about 18. So, I mean, I think it was a fairly, I don't know, I should have probably looked up the history more than, I don't know how much you'd find. I mean, did you find information on them?
I found it very hard to find. When you type in the Revenants,
you're going to get the film and you're going to get all kinds of stuff. You'll probably find more on Stars of Heaven.
There's a million articles about the film, the Revenants, and there's, you know, six articles about the band.
You mentioned, you said the word melancholic. To me, that's a quality in Stephen Ryan's voice that has always got me, like every time. And I used to go and see him and there's something that gets me right in the craw. And I can't explain it and I can't pin it down. And it's not a beautiful voice. It's not really, but something about that achy kind of break, it breaks at the top and it's sort of thin and reedy. But there's a quality to that that I think might be part of the charm, and I think is maybe part of the kind of emotional relationship that people at the time and subsequently have with the memory of the Stars of Heaven and the Revenant. So, and Stephen Ryan seemed to disappear off the face of the earth pretty much after the Revenants, which in my memory, they seemed like a fairly short-lived band. I think they released this album, and I don't know if there was a whole lot else.
They had another one called Somewhere Know How, I think, or something. I'm not exactly sure.
And then they seemed to just disappear. And he popped back up again with Eileen. You mentioned Eileen. Eileen Gogan. She's in the band The Drays with him and Connor...
Brady.
Connor Brady, thank you. I know Connor so well. And a cast of musicians who are really great. And I was quite surprised to see him resurface and very pleased. You know, and the funny thing is that The Drays don't sound terribly dissimilar to The Revenants. It's, from what I've heard of it, it's, there seems to be that choice or that production aesthetic, if you want to call it that, that's quite raw and unproduced, seems to be a choice, I think.
Do you think it's weird that Steve Ryan disappeared for ages and then came back, considering the meaning of
The Revenant?
Oh my God.
It was just as
the most elaborate marketing scheme of all time.
I think you're onto something.
There was a thing Jeff Travis said about you mentioned about Sack having a quality live that doesn't translate or doesn't necessarily translate.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't necessarily be as immediate on recording.
But he was saying that Jeff Travis and he's Jeff Travis from in the thing I read. He said that the Stars of Heaven, the only reason they weren't massive is because they weren't as good live as they should have been.
Possibly.
But that's interesting though as well, because that thing of them being live, I mean, we're talking about pop there, and pop, honestly, like the Pop Mart tour, that, you know, they came out of the lemon and all that.
Like Crow Park, lemon on a toothpick, wasn't it?
Yeah, like when they go back to, like, when they do sort of
it did get a
reeling
bit spinal
in the year kind of when they do that kind of stuff about that year, like pop, you know, around the world, pop is going to be in that, you know, like in the Cores, I'm sure there's, you know, their live performances and how they looked and how their videos were probably added enormously to how much the records sold and all that kind of stuff, you know. And as we're talking about the look of how David Holmes' cinematic music, you know, presents itself. And it's funny then, I wonder, was that one of the reasons that it affected, say, Sack? You know, how much did it affect the Revenants?
It's,
you know,
possible. I mean, I think there was the beginning of the sea change, and I think you can hear it in pop, and I think you can hear it in David Holmes. And you can, and some of the other records that you mentioned at the start of the show from that time, there were some really seminal ones there and that I listened to a lot at the time and were huge, like Homogenic by Björk. So I think, I wouldn't say the guitar was starting to die off, but it may have been,
I think you're right, though. I think it was depleting because there was this...
The guitar was having less currency as the main channel of music.
Yeah, well, and just electronic music was more interesting. That was where the innovations were being made.
And the dance culture began to take off, too. And it was never something that I was part of, but, you know, obviously I was very aware of it at the time, and that had a huge influence, even outside of the artists that were part of the scene, you know. So you had... I suppose you had some stuff that sort of seeped out from it, and then it was its own culture that didn't, I mean, it had its own chart that I would have been, you know, not necessarily clued into. Mm. But then you had stuff like Born Slippy. I don't know what year that was, but, you know,
you're also
it started to change around then.
Plus, you're about 2 years from Eminem's first single, I guess, as well, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, the massive mainstreaming and commercialization of hip-hop, which, you know, that became youth culture. So walking around with a guitar when everyone's, you know, you'd only you have it to, like, maybe learn to play Stan.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing is that it seemed, you know, it's really only kind of come back into vogue, if you like, with it's almost as if it's come back in the in the front door through pop, with your Ed Sheerans and your know, it's almost okay again.
Yeah, the funny thing about
to be
Ed Sheeran
a girl
is
or a boy with a guitar.
He does 500 different sounds with his, you know, guitar.
You know what I mean, though?
Yeah, like totally.
It's interesting as well. Like you were saying, the Starter Show, the Be Here Now was released this year, and that absolutely, I think, you know, was like overdose in guitars. I think it's a Be Here Now. Oasis.
That killed British guitar.
One of the most 5-star reviews.
At the time,
got so terrible.
So many 5-star reviews because everyone wanted to give them amazing reviews, so they would get the interview. It was so big.
I think everyone wanted it to be as big as everyone thought. You know, wasn't there such a big kind of thing around it?
It was. I remember watching MTV when they did a live. There was like going live with the first video, which was in the. You know? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's the helicopter.
The helicopter one.
And
they played the video. It was that lad, the MTV presenter, who kind of like a cheesy grin and quite long hair. He infamously interviewed Pete Doherty queuing for Be Here Now as a like a vox pop. And Pete Doherty was just there as a punter. And he's just like, I've always thought that, you know, Noel is blah, and said something like, you know, smart about Russian novelists or something. And basically, they did they went, you know, this was this live MTV news with the, you know, the Do You Know What I Mean video. Mm-hmm. And they played it 2 or 3 times in a row. And I was a big Oasis fan, kind of a closet Oasis fan. And like, I remember watching the video and the song going, this is terrible. Yeah. You know, even like as a 14-year-old or whatever. And I think that record really did a lot of damage to the legitimacy of guitar music at that time.
Just, even that video, I think, takes forever to start. Actually get to the song. You can see how bloated everything has gone.
Sounds like cocaine. Sounds like the lines.
Well, I frankly think if Oasis were left with the mantle of keeping guitar music going, I'm not surprised it died. That's how I feel about that band.
It's interesting to see, you know, obviously the Oasis Blur thing was, you know, that big thing at the time, but of the
Blur was also released this year, I think.
Oh really?
Yeah, which is a brilliant album.
Yeah, and it's a guitar album. At the same time though, like Britpop sort of and all that kind of stuff was fizzling out, you know.
94, 95 was Britpop.
Yeah, like when was Common People out? That's really the pinnacle of it, really. So, you know, everything was kind of starting to kind of dissipate, and I think, you know.
But I don't hear a lot of Britpop, you know. Although saying that, there's quite a bit of trip hoppy kind of Tintin out, you know, the fingers of the long spindly fingers of Tintin out reaches into every corner.
Damn you, Tintin out!
But you know what I mean? Like, I mean, like,
here's where the story ends.
Nice. Like the chorus of obviously it's just sounds so out of place in that album. David Holmes, it sounds at home in that album. But in pop, it sounds like they're trying to make it, you know, to try and make it work, you know. But you know, Sack and Butterfly and the Revenants don't have too much trip hop, and maybe that was where they went.
It possibly is.
So let's get everybody's recommendations, and we'll start with the little Digital Dave.
Ah, Pop, what a strange, curious beast you are. For about 16 minutes, you're looking to challenge the more showy aspects of Nine Inch Nails and Depeche Mode with pointed industrial swagger, and then you're looking to the heavens and holding back tears like a dime a dozen TV evangelist, practically grasping at the listener's heartstrings as you squeeze, squeeze, and then squeeze that little bit more. Honestly, there's a case you made here for If God Will Send His Angels at the single most cloying song in the entire YouTube catalogue, and it's not like there's a wholesale lack of contenders for that particular crown. Oh Pop, what whiplash you provoke. Seriously, what is this album? I'll tell you what it is. It's the last interesting U2 album, unless the future throws up anything of particular intriguing note, and I'm really not sure that it will. That's not to say that interesting necessarily translates to great, however, for Pop is utterly all over the shop. It pretty much achieves the noble failure tag before all is said and done, and sadly, its more interesting parts come early doors. Look, I'll fight for Discotheque until my dying day, but do you feel loved in Mofo or Worthy Brothers here? All of which feel like the hangover from U2's involvement with the Batman Forever and Mission Impossible soundtracks, and that, my friends, is no bad thing at all. You can feel the blueprint here for songs like Elevation, but that's a poor relative by comparison. What a shame, though, that this experimentation with samples, programming, and odd structures, well, odd for you too at least, wouldn't just pave the way for Safety and Blandness and All That You Can't Leave Behind in 2000, but would collapse under its own excess after just a few songs. I've said it before and I'll say it once again. U2 are wildly overhated. They've written some truly incredible songs, but they're also capable of being extremely fun. Or at least, they were. If their idea of fun now is Vertigo and the Miracle of Joy Ramone, well, that's just confirmation that we're not getting another Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me ever again, and that's a genuine shame. Finally, is Staring at the Sun a good song? I can never really tell.
Okay, great. Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave there. Kieran, which album would you recommend?
Oh, I am so torn. I don't think that in this list there is an album that stands head over heels over everything. But I think that there are a couple albums that I think people should listen to. So I find it very hard to choose from. But I'm going to suggest that, personally, maybe... You can
confidence,
edit this.
The confidence on show here.
Well, it's just hard because I... Okay,
so decisive.
So decisive. My head is saying David Holmes and Pop, but my heart is sort of saying Revenants and Sack, because you're looking at different things. You know, do you know what I mean? It's different things that you're telling people to go back to, but I think that the most satisfying album is probably David Holmes, so I'm going to say David Holmes.
Okay. Stephen?
I'm going to go with U2, Zupra. I'm going to go with U2 Pop for all the things I manically shouted at you for 5 minutes.
Excellent.
That's fair. Una?
I'm going to go with David Holmes for Innovation and an Irish album that's truly global.
Okay.
And Carol?
Well, it's funny enough, I think Kieran kind of said, actually both Kieran and Una have kind of summed up my feelings after the end of everything, because I didn't give due time to David Holmes, because I kind of felt I got guided towards other things that I wanted to cover. And actually, I think it probably does deserve it. It's just not to say that the others are not thoroughly deserving. But I think it kind of tops for that for the reasons that have been given already.
Okay, so I mean, we're at...
I didn't expect that at all.
There you go.
So we're at three for David Holmes.
You made such a good case for Luna.
Three for David Holmes and two for you two. Is it... Would it be fair to give both of them to say that these are
two albums? I think that would be unfair.
Oh,
because David Holmes got three and you two got two.
And I also think that as much as we can be kind of affectionate with pop now, it is a mess.
Album.
Do you know? And like, it is flawed beyond that kind of barrier of where it's flawed and the flaws make it even better. The flaws in pop are not... don't necessarily make it better. Like, it is kind of crappy and kind of deadly. But I think in terms of, you know, the thing about pop is it's badly executed. And I don't think you can award it something, you know. I think we can all like it, like a little weird little kitten that comes out wrong or whatever. But not
I wouldn't like a weird little kitten.
But ultimately, let's face it, guys.
That kitten's called Satan.
You know what I mean, though, right?
Where's like, recorded Dave when I need him?
Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
So our gold album is...
Our gold album is David Holmes.
Let's Get Killed. And then U2 Pop can be a silver album with a little bit of gold plating on it.
It can have like, a little tiny...
Golden way. Glitter or something like
glitter.
That.
Glitter. It has some glitter on it.
Okay,
you
so
did
Una.
Not get my silver vote. Just saying.
That's fair.
So we'll play out with a little bit of David Holmes.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.